Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Jennifer Corning, and we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Characteristics of grit: courage, perseverance, resilience, and passion. Now, at a rodeo arena, crowded stands, a 2,000-pound bull, and Johnny Jankowski. That's grit in Wranglers. Montana legend Johnny Jankowski is featured in a new Montana PBS documentary. Her challenges and accomplishments are beyond what most of us will experience. Johnny and director-producer Sabrina Lee are here to talk about Johnny's life and the upcoming film, Johnny.
Welcome to the studio, Johnny and Sabrina. This is such a delight to have you here. Johnny, it would seem that, you know, most people have a life. You have had many lives.
A cat,
Let's
for
start
sure.
With the beginning. Where did you grow up?
Born in Fargo, North Dakota. Lived there for 5 years. Transferred to Bismarck with my folks. And when I was 9, I moved to Billings and pretty much been calling Billings home ever since. But pretty much a city kid, but always loved horses and dogs and running. That was my thing.
Well, I think most people know you as a famous bronc and bull rider. But there's a little history before that. You were actually a runner. Tell us about that story.
You know, I would like to think I was a standout track athlete. I wasn't in grade school by any means. I was last all the time. I was a late bloomer in high school. I grew up 8 inches and started getting stronger and faster. And then pretty soon, you know, I was doing excelling in high school and had my vision and focus on pentathlon in the 76 Olympic Games. And that's truly was my 24/7, 365, is all I could do was do that.
Johnny, I can tell we're about the same age because I remember the 76 Olympics in Barcelona.
Yeah.
I was in Barcelona running the streets. I was a big runner. And people would say, Americano, Americano.
Oh, right.
They thought that I was a part of that.
All right. Well, good for you.
But you were actually a competitor, a serious competitor.
Well, I was trying. Yeah, I got hurt in the trials. So, I mean, that's the story of many athletes. You know, you're this close and you train and, you know, you hope for that one day. And I didn't make it. You know, I crashed and I really had to heal up and figure out another competitive line in my life. And there
okay.
you go.
Okay, I understand people being a track star and then they can't do that. They usually go to golf.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know many people, let alone women, that decide to become rough stock rodeo.
Well, you know, I had no desire. I had no plans to become one. I had worked on dude ranches when I was 13 and 14 years old, and I got exposed a little bit to Margie and Alice Greeno, who were bronc riders and bull riders in the 30s and 40s and 50s. My boss used to brag about them, how amazing they were. They did their own hair. They made their own clothes. They were extremely feminine, and they were tough as heck. So, you know, and later I got to meet them, but that was in the back of my mind. I always, you know, heard those stories. Really never had any desire to do it, but then the opportunity knocked when I was sitting in a restaurant having coffee with my mom, and then lo and behold, I saw a poster advertising a rodeo in Red Lodge, Montana, where the Greenos were from. And I thought, well, what the heck? You know, how tough can this be? Other people do this. So 2 weeks, there you go. I was ready.
I think a couple months ago, we had an interview with Barbara Van Cleve.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, my gosh.
She's a dear friend.
I would imagine. And she is sort of an epitome of, I mean, she's such a scholar. She is so intelligent, bright, and I don't think she's ever not worn a pair of Levi's and been on a horse. I mean, it is such an interesting dichotomy for some, but that's what a woman born on a ranch does. You weren't born on a ranch.
No, not even close. I was growing up in the city, a city kid. When I got into the rodeo thing, my mom truly thought it was a phase. You know, she'll try it once and she'll be done with it and move on. Well, it didn't happen. And it was really hard. I mean, to gain success in that sport without the support of your family, because farm kids and ranch kids, they grow up on sheep and cows and the whole deal. And so the family encourages them to do that. And I didn't have that opportunity of my folks encouraging me to do that. So, and in fact, if anything, they would deny it to anybody and everybody. Like, I don't know why she's doing this. We didn't tell her to do it. We don't encourage her to do it. She just went. And yeah, it truly was just going to be an opportunity for a year or two to take a picture of myself riding bulls until I figured out what I was going to do. And that was it.
So what was it in your background growing up that gave you the tenacity to take on something like that?
You know, so many people ask me that, and it's been the drive to win and compete has been with me since I can remember. I remember racing my cousins when I was 3, 4, 5 years old. I remember running against them. I remember biking against them. I remember challenging my uncles when I was 10, 11, 12. I mean, constant fitness and running. It was just my obsession, and if I could still do it, I would. You know, I still walk a jillion miles, and I still bike and ride, but I mean, that's just something that I think you're born with. You can't be taught that. It has to be instilled in you that that's just your drive.
Well, I know boys don't like to be beat by girls in races or in basketball yeah. games. Tell me what it must have been like for you going into the rodeo arena. What was the reaction of the men that were involved in the sport that you were taking on?
You know, in the beginning, I was really a novelty when I started to compete, mostly just to get on stock. I would ride in rodeos where it was just men, you know, just the NRAs, which are local rodeos, or the PRCAs. I would look for stock. But most off, when I would ride, when it finally got sanctioned events in the men's event, I mean, it was the guys on one side of the room, the girls on the other. It kind of looked like a high school dance. I mean, the curiosity factor was overwhelming. But when you could show your grit and your prowess and that you knew what you were doing, that you would get and rope up your bull yourself and, you know, get all your equipment ready yourself and nod your head yourself and do whatever, you pray, even though you don't ride every one of them, you just pray to heaven you look like you could do it. You at least look like you had the talent to do it. And I learned very quickly on that I needed these men in order to compete in that event. I needed their help. I needed their help behind the chutes. I needed their support. And that was, you know, and the biggest and most important thing to me was they needed to know that I was a girl. And I was a woman, and I was feminine, and I was a gal that wanted to ride bulls. I wasn't a girl trying to be a guy riding bulls. I think that really helped. I think that they understood the difference of what I was trying to do. And ultimately, in 92, when I competed against the men in the World Championships, they were all on my side. I had gone up and down the road for so long that they knew I lived in my pickup, in the back of my car, and starved to
like
death.
Like all rodeo people do. You don't got it. You didn't have any favoritism being a woman?
No, I starved like the rest of them, man. And rodeo just doesn't pay. It doesn't even pay today. It's just a horrible addiction, let me tell you. It truly is. Either have that in your vein or you don't, and I truly wish that many times I hadn't had it, but I did.
Well, the other thing, Johnny, you had the tenacity, the drive, but you are also a natural. You were a 2-time world champion, and you've also been inducted to the Cowgirl Hall of Fame, the Montana Cowboy Hall of Fame.
Yep.
Tell us about those moments, that winning ride. What was that like?
There's never anything quite like a winning ride. When I won the world title in 88, I drew a bull that Don Gay, 8-time world champion PRCA rider, had in his world finals just months before mine. He drew that bull and it bucked him off. And he said, "Johnny, you can ride this bull." He said, "I'll tell you how to ride him, you know, but you're going to ride him." And to have Dottie there coaching me where to put my rope, how to set it a little bit, because he'd been on him. The bull was awkwardly built, long neck, long shoulders, odd body, and he just told me what to do to handle the whip a little bit better. And I rode him out to win it. And afterwards, Donnie Gay was the commentator for TNN, and he did the interview after. And it was pretty exciting moment when you can stand next to a guy that's 8-time world champion in the men's division, and you just rode a bull that bucked him off. So that felt pretty darn good.
Oh, I bet. I love that story. I think we're going to find out a little bit more about that story when we see the film. Is that true?
Well, maybe it's possible.
So aside from the adrenaline rush, there are some downsides. And you got tossed, stepped on, and dragged, and have had multiple injuries.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you have to have a regular job somewhere, too. You know, we call ourselves weekend warriors because you would mostly just compete from Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So you'd have a regular job from 8 to 5 during the week. I was a zoning inspector for the city for a time. I painted signs and billboards, and I did about anything I could to still give me the freedom to travel and compete. I worked at Deluxe Check Printers making checks. I mean, you name it, anything to do it, because truly every rodeo event I went to, I would probably win 500 in the hole. I mean, I was competing against girls in Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, you know, Mississippi, Missouri, all down there, and I would have to get there and to fly there and then hook up there. I mean, you're looking at airfare, cars, meals, hotel. It's expensive. And then you'd maybe win $300 if you won, and you'd go home, you know?
And it's not a team event. It's not like you get on the team bus and drive to the next town.
No, the only time it's a team event is if everybody bucks off and you split the money. That's the only time.
So your fascinating life is depicted in an upcoming Montana PBS documentary. Sabrina, you are the director, the producer. You put it all together, and I believe it was your idea. Tell us what made you know that this was going to be the film you wanted to do.
Sure. Thank you for having me. And Johnny, it's great to be sitting next to her in your studio. So a few years ago, I just had this idea that it would be really cool to make a film about young women's rodeo in Montana. And I was early on in the research stages, and circling back to Barb Van Cleve, had an opportunity to sit down and have lunch with her. And she said, oh, you can't make a film about women's rodeo without talking to Johnny Jonkowski. So the phone call I made to Johnny, I thought was purely going to be for research. But 2 hours later, after she had given me the abbreviated version of her life story, I hung up the phone and said to myself, this warrants its own documentary. And I completely pivoted, drove out to her ranch, had a great meeting with her in person, got to see where she lived, got to see her animal rescue, and then just was on fire with this idea. Pitched it to Montana PBS because I knew it was a uniquely Montana story, that it would just completely resonate with their viewers, and away we went.
I think it's interesting that you had an idea and a theme for a story, and then when you got to the source material, you realized that was the theme of the story.
Yes, I think that happens more often than we hear about, actually. I mean, that's happened on a couple occasions before, is that you're in the process of learning about this subject. One of the reasons that I wanted to make the documentary is I was interested in rodeo in Montana and I didn't know a lot about it. So if you're going to direct a film about something and spend 3 hours in the tunnel with it, it has to be something that's both fascinating to you and that you don't know a lot about. You're learning as you go. So I think inevitably the director's path is to be aware of what they're learning along the way and listen to where the story takes them, instead of being, you know, determined to stick to what it was that you thought you were going to do. Because, you know, what did they say about life? It's what happens when you're busy making plans. And so this was...
Ours was truly that. We had a dialogue planned when we started this whole project. And I think we went off script like the second day. I mean, my life is just like that. Well, guess what happened today, Sabrina?
We have an ongoing joke that it's the never-ending story. I mean, since we finished filming this, Johnny's rescued several horses, Lainey, Larry, Buddy. She has a donkey on the way. She rang the bell at the New York Stock Exchange just a couple months ago. I mean, we could still be filming right now. Part two, Johnny part two, stay tuned.
Sabrina, one of my favorite Montana documentaries is Class C, about girls basketball. And you hear the name of it and you know what it's going to be about, but you have to dig deep. I mean, it is a lot of time put in to make that story. Were you prepared to really cover Johnny's life? And how do you go about that? And what were the hurdles to make the film?
I'm so glad you brought up Class C, because it's one of my favorite documentaries of all time. And it's not a coincidence that Shasta Grenier, who is one of the directors of that film, partnered with me on Not Yet Begun to Fight, which was another Montana PBS co-production, and was the consulting editor on Johnny. So she's had a significant hand in the crafting of this story. But yes, that's a great question, because the hurdles are unknown when you start, right? You're like, stars in your eyes, this is going to be amazing. And I guess, you know, what was interesting about Johnny's story is one of the first tasks when you're setting off to make a film is that you write a three-act structure. Knowing what I know about the story, this is what it's going to be. But lots of interference, among them, a devastating flood that became an integral part of the story, because it affected Johnny's...
Everything,
yeah. So to be sure, that was a challenge. Also, just getting the archival. I mean, Johnny has had a ton of coverage, a ton of press coverage when she was riding bulls. You know, she was on 48 Hours. She was on David Letterman. She was on Street Stories. You know, it costs money to acquire that footage. The archival process was extremely arduous and complicated. And I'm very grateful to my co-producer, Scott Sterling, and the archival producer, Jennifer Grace, for tracking it all down. And we finally, you know, just in the last few weeks, got the final approval that we were cleared to use everything we need to tell Johnny's story. And on top of that, I'm very grateful to Joan Jett and crew, because in the opening credits, there's a great tune by hers, which will make perfect sense when you watch the film. But they also were incredibly generous when they learned about Johnny's story and allowed us to use the song, knowing that Montana PBS is completely funded by donations.
Did you have a message for this documentary? And I'm wondering if it changed while you were making the film. And Johnny, I guess the question also applies to you. Was there a message that you wanted to share with the world?
Pure survival. Just don't quit. Have a little faith. Honest to heaven, my life has never been even. It's either really high or really low, honestly. But you can recover. The only time you won't recover is when you quit, or you decide you can't make it, or you decide, you know, it's over in your brain. And I never, never, ever allow that thought process to come into my mind. And I think that is portrayed over and over in this film, that just pick yourself up and keep going, because, you know, I mean, I have one line in there. I know where you finish if you quit, and it's last, and I don't want to be last.
And I'd just like to add to that, at first blush, Johnny is this incredibly tough, resilient character, and that is absolutely true. But what's equally fascinating to me is that she's also an incredibly tender-hearted human being. And her humanity is really what carries this film, because it's a story of a bull rider, but it's also the story of somebody who's so invested in her community, cares so deeply about people who have less than she does, goes to incredible lengths to rescue these animals who have been left for dead. So, like, the duality of that, to show that you can be somebody who's strong and determined, but it is not a weakness to also feel what's happening around you and even take action. So,
cry a lot.
Yeah, I was about to say that. Johnny, the first time Johnny cried, I was kind of relieved, because I was like, wow, that's the person in there. And yeah, so that was important to me, to show both sides of Johnny.
Johnny, you retired in 2000 at the age of 46, which is about 26 years older than most people retire from the sport.
And not many people take up a new sport at 22 either. So,
well, do you miss it?
All the time, every day. Yeah.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, I really do. You know, I wish there was a format for women to this day. You know, I was very fortunate. We had a rodeo association that belonged to, the Professional Women's Rodeo Association. It dissolved in the mid-90s and went away, so the format for a lot of the gals to ride. I had the ability when I was riding to also promote and to market and to get my sport out there and noticed, and the exposure. I just had that gift because I wanted it for myself. It was selfish as well. But, you know, I could get the girls to tag along and ride anywhere that I wanted them to go, but that was all they would do. They wouldn't do the radio appearances. They wouldn't do the TV appearances. I mean, part of showing up at a rodeo somewhere, especially Cheyenne, is a week in advance. You got to let them know you're there. I mean, you're got to be on every TV, every radio, every board, every committee, every political party, every whatever to market it. And I mean, sometimes it's 4:30 in the morning on the radio, and I would bring up to my friends, you know, come on, let's go, you guys. You got to be kidding me. It's 4:30 in the morning. I ain't doing that. And, you know, but there was everybody who go, my gosh, Johnny, you must have been the only one. Well, heavens no. I mean, there was 30 or 40 girls riding when I was riding, but I had the drive just to get it out there and get the exposure.
Johnny, you have moved on to a new passion, Angel Horses. And I think people in Billings are very aware of the program. But tell our listeners about Angel Horses, its mission, and its history.
You know, Angel Horses started in 1998, so we're in like our 28th year or whatever. But after my rodeo career and my TV career, when I went out to apply for jobs and apply for work, my resume wasn't quite the usual norm, you know, while I rode bulls for the last 20-some years, and I did talk shows and game shows, and I had a TV series, and I did American Gladiators, and they're like, yeah, whatever. That's fine, but you wouldn't be happy here. I mean, I couldn't even get a dishwashing job. So basically, I went to school and, you know, just learned to trade. The best thing I could think of was a way to make my mom more comfortable. She was suffering from Parkinson's and ultimately passed. I knew there had to be a better way to make her life better, so I specialized in the geriatrics. And after my second year there at the senior center, I fell passionate for a gal named Ruby. She was 99. It was going to be her 99th birthday. I asked her what I could get her for her 99th birthday. She was extremely arthritic. She needed a Hoyer lift to get her out of bed. She had the function of her first finger and her thumb. She couldn't see very well. And she says, oh, Johnny, I want a painting horse more than anything. Dad would never let us have painting horses. And so I went out and bought her a Briar painting horse to put by her bed. And I showed it to her. And he says, well, Ruby, I says, here, I brought you a painting horse. She's just like, a little dull smile, not the enthusiasm I was expecting. Anyway, I says, well, how does he make you feel? And she goes, well, happy. And I says, well, let's call him Happy. Well, so we took Happy the next day. We set Happy on their bedstand. The next day I came in to do therapy, and Happy wasn't there. And I said, well, where's Happy? And she said, somebody stole him. Oh. And I go, this is a situation where they have nothing personal. They're in a metal bed, metal nightstand, share a commode, divide by curtain, no personal effects. And somebody stole the only personal effect that she had, was this little horse. But that gave me the gift to give her what she really wanted anyway, which was a black and white real pony. So I had one. So I worked with the staff and the nursing staff, and we figured out how to get my horse Buddy into her room. So we pine-sawed him up, put rubber boots on, we clippity-clopped him down the hall with a bucket full of grain, and I laid it on her stomach. and she looked in the pail, and Buddy was eating at the same time, and she scratched his nose with the two fingers that she has, and she said, "My God, Johnny, I can smell him." And I was fired the next day. And so ultimately, I just realized how easy it was to make somebody happy. Horses and animals have an incredible gift of healing. And it took a little bit to massage exactly how we wanted to make it work. But now we're strictly focused on seniors, cancer patients at risk, you know, memory care, that sort of thing at no cost to them. Because obviously we're dealing with clientele that can't afford anything. Mm-hmm. So,
Sabrina, did you know that was going to be part of this story?
I knew it was going to be part of the story, but it was much different being a witness to it and filming it and seeing it and seeing the expressions of the seniors as they're petting the horses. You can hear them chuckling and recalling stories from their childhood, the ones who are not in memory care and the ones who are in memory care. To be sure, and Johnny, I know we've talked about this at length, it jogs something in their memory. And I think that they feel a certain peace being at the farm. And another aspect of this, which Johnny hasn't really talked about, is just the warmth they feel when they come and have an Angel Horses experience. These are people who maybe aren't getting a lot of human contact. And the number of hugs and kisses and opportunity to dance to some really great live music and have a picnic lunch outside, Johnny has really taken such care to make it a real experience for them that I think from what I hear talking to some of the facilitators at the assisted living facilities, it's a lasting impact for them. So it's just...
Yeah, the hardest part for us is to put them back on the bus. Because once they've experienced that outing, mm-hmm. they don't want to get back on the bus and go back. You know, and the horses that we use are all rescues. They all are given a second chance. And I think they're aware of that as well. And one horse that we follow through the film was Jasper. We rescued him out of the slaughter pen in Bowie, Texas. And he was truly pathetic when he arrived, beyond anything that we could even conceive of. He had issues. He was truly the first horse in my lifetime I prayed would pass on because I hadn't seen a horse suffer so much and still stay alive.
He had a purpose still.
He had a purpose. And he was a champion as well. Our stories kind of ran. It turns out that this particular horse actually was a harness racing horse out of Chicago. He had won over $1.5 million. He was in the money 184 out of 201 starts. And at 7 years old, he wasn't winning anymore. So they sent him for hard labor for 15-hour days, 7 days a week. I can't even imagine what went through his brain to go from the perfect food, from walking, massage, chiropractic adjustment, to that kind of life, and then be sent to slaughter. And you know.
Well, it takes someone like you, Johnny, who has been through all those things.
Yeah, I do. I think we saw each other. I think we saw each other in each other's eyes. I truly do.
What a wonderful interview. Sabrina and Johnny, thank you so much for being here. I want our listeners to know we'll have more information about the Montana PBS film, Johnny, and it is going to be showing all over the state coming soon.
Thank you guys.
Very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Corby Skinner, Jennifer Corning, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at yprradio.org.